John Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. A letter is how former President Trump found out that he is the target of a grand jury investigation into alleged attempts to overturn the 2020 election. CBS's Robert Costa.
The former president confirmed the development on social media, lashing out at the special counsel, calling him deranged, and revealing he was given 4 days to report to a grand jury, saying an arrest and indictment were expected.
The special counsel would not have sent a target letter and would not be apparently poised to actually bring a prosecution against former President Trump if he didn't think he had a winning hand.
That's former federal prosecutor Tom Dupree. Michigan's attorney general charges 16 Republicans with conspiracy to commit election forgery for allegedly acting as fake electors for then-President Trump during the 2020 election. In a statement on social media, Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel says it was an organized effort to circumvent the lawfully cast ballots of millions of Michigan voters.
We believe the evidence will demonstrate that there was no legal authority for the false electors to purport to act as duly elected presidential electors and execute the false electoral documents.
Phoenix eclipses the big city record of consecutive hot days. For 19 days, the city has hit at least 110 degrees, according to National Weather Service meteorologist Tom Frieders.
The forecast continues to call for temperatures from 115 to 120, continuing to expand across the region through the end of the week and possibly into the weekend. So we're in this for quite a while yet. And again, it's that prolonged heat that becomes more serious.
Search efforts are intensifying outside Philadelphia for a toddler and her baby brother who were swept away by flash floods in Bucks County on Saturday. Upper Makefield Fire Chief Tim Brewer.
The two are still missing. We are continuing to do what we have done in the last 3 days. Ground search, water search, sonar, river, canine, cadavers.
Actors join writers on the picket line in New York City as they brace for a long standoff with studios.
Actor Kira Sedgwick marched at Rockefeller Plaza in New York next to her husband, Kevin Bacon.
I think it's going to be a long road. Could be really hard.
As for the economic impact to places where movies and TV shows are shot, Chris Thornburg with Beacon, an economic consulting firm in L.A., says for now there isn't much of a change.
The strike are people who are involved with creating more stock. So it's almost like a strike at the Ford plant. But to be clear, Ford has tons and tons of cars in the lot ready to be sold. It doesn't matter until they run out of cars.
He says over time, pressure will start to build as that stock diminishes. Matt Piper, CBS News, New York.
This is CBS News.
Need to hire quality candidates fast? You need Indeed, the end-to-end hiring solution. Attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles, and here's what you need to know. In a closely contested election 3 years ago, the race for the 24th Assembly District was one of the tightest in the state. Today, voters in that district will have until 8 p.m. to participate in the special election, aiming to fill the vacancy left by former Representative Dan Knodel. The district includes parts of Washington, Ozaukee, and Waukesha counties. Milwaukee County residents are potentially looking at a rise in county taxes as two county board committees have given their approval to a proposal that seeks to raise the sales tax from 0.5% to 0.9%.
This is a moment for leadership. This is a moment for people to be decisive.
Milwaukee County Board Supervisor Sean Rowland says the primary goal is to safeguard services such as public transit and health and human services from budget cuts. The county board will vote on the matter July 27th. With news on WAUK, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
Attention, Wisconsin veterans.
Hello, I'm Tony Evers, the governor of Wisconsin. If you are a veteran struggling to pay for rent, utilities, or other life-sustaining services, I want you to know that the Veterans Rental Assistance Program is here to help. You have already made a most noble sacrifice. You shouldn't have to continue doing so. We are here to support you. The Veterans Rental Assistance Program was created by and for people living in Wisconsin, with benefit approvals being issued to veterans in just days, not months. It's never easy to ask for assistance, but rest assured, we're here to help. You've always been there for us. We want you to know that we're here for you. Call 833-WISVRAP. That's 833-947-8727, or visit VRAPWI.com. On behalf of the state of Wisconsin, thank you.
This summer, 540 AM WAUK has a new lineup.
Yes, that's awesome.
Starting at 6 AM, Up North News, 8 to 10, The Earl Ingram Show. Mondays, 8 to 9, Under the Helmet with the Grave Digger, Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crude. And 6 to 7, The Maggie Dawn Show. On 540 AM. WAUK.
Don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at therickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, I got to tell you, it's a hot summer. It's, you know, a lot of my labor friends saying it's a hot strike summer. And they're going to be, you know, I look at my Teamster brothers and sisters at UPS. 340,000 of them, you know, come a couple of days, they may be walking the picket line. Are my friends at Yellow Freight. They, in a couple of days, may be walking the picket line. We see the folks at SAG-AFTRA. We see the folks at the Writers Guild. Lots of people walking the picket line. And I got a press release today that the flight attendants, 26,000 flight attendants at American Airlines, they're about to authorize a strike. And that's why I've asked Paul Hartshorn to come talk with us. He's the National Communications Chair for the Association of Professional Flight Attendants. They represent those 26,000 flight attendants at American Airlines. Paul, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So, like I said, this is strike summer. Everywhere I look, there are workers saying, hey, we want better wages, hours, conditions. We want better opportunities. And now I see your 26,000 members are about to take a strike authorization vote. What's got us to this point?
Yeah, it's a hot labor summer, hot strike summer for sure. Look, this is just the next step here in the process. The transportation workers, flight attendants, pilots, anyone at the airline is governed under Section 6 of the Railway Labor Act. There is a strict process to follow as you go through your way to securing a new contract. Currently, the flight attendants, the 26,000 flight attendants at American Airlines, have filed for and begun federal mediation under the auspices of the National Mediation Board. We started that in March. Talks have been moving, but not moving very quickly, not looking like Americans really, really in a rush to get to a deal. So the next step for us is a strike authorization vote, where we ask our 26,000 members to support us and support the negotiating committee if they feel that we should be released or request to be released from mediation and move into a cooling off period and then a strike.
Now, you know, we learned a lot about the Railway Labor Act during the train talks. What are the chances that a strike, and now this is again well down the road, as you've said, there are steps to get to this. What are the chances a strike on the airlines, especially an airline as large as American, would be allowed to go forward? Any thoughts?
It's concerning. The size of these labor groups at the airlines now, especially after these mega mergers that we've seen for the last 20, 25 years, is concerning. But it doesn't negate the fact that the Railway Labor Act has a process which we must follow. And we also must ask the National Mediation Board for a release. There will come a time where we will reach an impasse if we don't receive a contract, and they will have to release us hopefully into a cooling off period. It's the next step. This strike authorization vote moves us towards that. Look, our union has passed proposals on every section of the contract. We passed a large comprehensive economic proposal in March. March 7th, to be exact, we have not heard back from American Airlines yet. These are 26,000 flight attendants that work through a pandemic. These are 26,000 flight attendants, I think, that we talked about last time we talked, that have been physically assaulted, have been mass policed for the past 4 years, have seen their staffing on board the aircraft cut because the planes were empty during COVID. Surprisingly, that staffing has not returned now that the passengers and the profits have. So yeah, it's a concern for us about being released. We hope we don't get there. The strike authorization vote is the next step in the process, and we'll keep moving forward. We have to get a contract for these flight attendants. It's been over 4 years since they've seen a pay raise or any quality of life improvements.
4 years since they've gotten the pay raise. And look, with all the inflation that we've had, you know, their wages are based. How do you, I guess the question that I have, how does anyone stay?
It's been tough. It's been tough. We've lost a lot of good people. You know, I mean, I think you know that during the COVID, I think we talked about this back in January, we had a lot of people take early outs where they were able to thankfully leave with union negotiated medical care rather than just leaving when we were overstaffed. And then we saw in June of that 2021 that all of a sudden the passengers came back full force. Very grateful to have people back and feel safe flying again. But we weren't staffed correctly. I mean, anyone can see that. We were not staffed correctly. We were not ready. Any airline, I believe, was ready for the return and the surge of the capacity that came back. So our flight attendants have been through a lot. It's been really difficult 4 years. This contract that we're currently working under became amendable over 4 years ago, at the end of 2018. You know, as in the Railway Labor Act, contracts don't expire, obviously, they become amendable. So it's time. It's time for American Airlines to come to the table. It's time for American Airlines to stop making small moves here and there. It's time for them to respond to our economic proposal so we can get going on this negotiation and give these flight attendants what they deserve. And I will say, I mean, you look around, we're not the only airline labor group going through this. It's pilots, it's flight attendants. You name the airline right now, they've been through hell and back. Let's give them a raise. Let's get us back to where we should be.
No, I mean, treat them like the heroes and the essential workers you said they were. And that showing them how much you believe in them being heroes is what's in your paycheck, what's in your benefits, what's in the conditions that you work under. Not platitudes, not pats on the back, not shiny little badges for your shirt, but actual tangible things that you can take home to your family.
It's definitely time. I mean, we've been through a lot, as with any essential worker on the ground and in the air over the past few years. It's time to do this. And look, American Airlines is about to announce profits in 2 days on the 20th. It'll be interesting to see what those are, because we don't feel like we're sharing them in them right now. You know, we've seen our profit sharing is paltry. The bonuses for the executives are rolling in. When is this going to end? It's time. We really should not even be talking about a strike authorization vote this evening.
No, and this is where I asked my next question, and you kind of rolled over it, was, you know, how profitable are they? I mean, I look at UPS. UPS made, their revenue was over $100 billion. They pocketed almost $14 billion in pure profits after a couple billion in stock buybacks, and they want a cost-neutral contract, which is just, you know, to be able to say that out loud is totally ludicrous. But, you know, I assume American is back to profitable. I'm assuming that they're rolling in and CEOs are doing well. How come that never seems to trickle down?
Americans return to profitability. We've seen it with the bonuses that management's received. You know, we received our paltry 1.3% profit sharing, which was kind of a slap in the face after everything we've been through. They've returned to profitability. They're going to return to profitability even more on Thursday. And for the flight attendants and the other work groups at this airline and airlines across the country to just sit here and keep waiting, it's really unbelievable. Again, the economic proposal has been in their hands since the beginning of March. We're in July right now. It's time. So we have to move this process forward. We are going to continue with our federal mediators that have been assigned to the American Airlines flight attendants to keep this process moving forward. They met with our negotiating committee last week. They're meeting again next week. And we're really, really looking for some meaningful progress next week to bring this to a close. American Airlines just needs to step up to the plate. They know they need to do it, and they know they need to treat their employees well.
Is there a way for us to pressure, or is there a way, you know, emails, calls, social media? I look at these greedy corporations that, you know, that are making a lot of money. They just don't seem to want to share with the people who actually create the profits. That's the weird thing for me, Paul, that, you know, it's the workers, it's the people on the ground who make that service go. You're a service industry. The people who are the ones who are dealing with your customers or taking care of your customers, those are the ones you should be taking care of.
It's really unfortunately not weird to me, because if you think back to what we had to do during COVID with the CARES Act to keep these airlines afloat, and how much money the government gave these airlines to stay afloat, you have to remember what that language said. Yeah. They actually had to write language in there saying this couldn't be used for stock buybacks. They had to actually put language in there saying this had to go to your employees only, to support your employees, to keep your employees connected, not only to their pay, but to their health benefits during a pandemic. So when you have to write language in there similar to that, those kind of things, to make sure the money is used properly, I'm not sure what that tells you. I guess everyone can come to their own assumptions, but this is what we're dealing with. You're absolutely right. These absolutely huge corporations, if you want to just make it about the airline industry, these mega carriers that have been allowed to merge over the past 20 years, and they need to share it with the frontline employees, not just the flight attendants. It's everybody. It's our ground staff. It's Airport Workers United, our friends over at SEIU. We just picketed with them the other day in Dallas and Phoenix, and it's just absolutely unbelievable what they're going through just to fight, you know, to get their a pay raise, to just make it through the month. Yeah. So yeah, it's across the board. It needs to change. We're just one piece of the puzzle, but strike authorization vote is opening July 28th. It's going to close on August 29th. And on the 30th, we'll announce the results and have our fourth system-wide picket. You did ask how the public can support us. We get support all the time on the plane, you know, go flight attendants. We get support at our pickets. We get support through the media and our social media, and we're very grateful of that. I want to make sure that our flying passengers know we are very grateful that they've returned. We're fighting for the return for staffing, so you receive better service on board the aircraft like you used to pre-COVID. So this is all about everyone, and we're all in this together.
Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Paul Hartshorn. He's the National Communications Chair for the Association of Professional Flight Attendants. They represent 26,000 workers, flight attendants at American Airlines. If you want to check out more on what they do, APFA.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media on how you can take a look at that. Now, you brought up, a couple of times you've brought up the fact that American and a lot of these airlines have been able to consolidate. You know, we were told competition. Is this really the bigger issue in all of this, that these companies are so big that they pretty much feel that they have the power to do whatever they want, and government be damned? Because my fear is, like the railroads, they know that no matter how pro-labor Joe Biden was, they were never going to be allowed to strike, because it would have done such harm to our economy. You know, isn't this a moment where we look at the airlines and go, maybe they shouldn't be so big?
You know, I mean, I always say what's done is done, and we have to deal with it now. Yeah. I don't know. It's an interesting question, because we receive that question a lot. Oh, would you ever be able to strike? I mean, who's going to let 26,000 flight attendants walk out? There's intent in the Railway Labor Act, and we have negotiating attorneys. We have a bunch of unions, our sibling unions, pilots, flight attendants, ground workers, who are going to make sure that our rights that are contained in the Railway Labor Act aren't suffocated because of our size. That was never the deal, right? The deal for the Railway Labor Act is to protect the interstate commerce, to keep commerce moving, goods moving between states. And that's something they're going to have to come up with, because 26,000 flight attendants here, 27,000 flight attendants at another airline, 10,000 pilots at another airline are not just going to settle for rights being taken away that are included in the Railway Labor Act, period.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm there with you. I keep saying that anytime there's going to be a strike or even an informational picket, go out and adopt a striker, go out and double the size of the picket lines. Because as I've always said, the bigger the pickets, the shorter the strike. And that's what we want. I did, before I let you go, I got another line of questioning I wanted to ask you about, because there's talk of reauthorizing the FAA, this Securing Growth and Robust Leadership in American Aviation Act, House Resolution 3935. Basically, it's just a reauthorization of the FAA. You guys got any position on this? Which way to go? A lot of my union friends say this has to be done. Where are you guys at?
Yeah, this has to be done by this fall. It has to be done by this fall. We have to fund the FAA. Our government affairs department at our union works closely with congressional representatives. We have people located in Washington, D.C. who do this every day on behalf of our union. We have our government affairs representatives working across unions, at airlines, at railroads, you name it, working with congressional representatives who support us and who do not necessarily support us, to try to make sure that we have certain things in that bill that we need to see, certain specific things that affect our safety, things that we've been trying to get through for years. One example would be the temperature in the cabin. There's no regulation for how hot it can be when we board these passengers. So it can be a company policy, but that needs to get into the FAA reauthorization bill. Things of that nature. That's just one example. But yeah, no, that has to be done this fall. We have people diligently working on it, like I said, at our union, working with other unions, and we hope to have more information on that soon. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, I know. One of the things that's interesting to me is, and I don't think most people know, that a lot of the maintenance, the mechanical work done on these aircraft are done overseas in places like El Salvador, I'm told, where you go, I don't know that I feel comfortable with that. I think I would prefer, I don't know, here. But yeah, I guess that's part of this as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of that happened during the great, you know, bankruptcies after 9/11, right? A lot was outsourced. I probably not just in airlines, probably across industries, right? But that's definitely a big. I won't speak too much about it. I'm not a mechanic. I appreciate their work, and I'm not sure exactly where they are on that. But yeah, that's all stuff that has to be included. We have a lot of interest when it comes, you know, to the FAA reauth bill. And we're hoping to hear more on that soon. But we are definitely doing our work on Capitol Hill to try to make sure that our supporters in the Congress are, you know, on board with that, and make sure they realize what is important to us, and more importantly, why it's important.
Important stuff. You do good work. Yeah. Paul, I appreciate you taking time for us. I hope we don't get to a strike scenario. I hope this gets settled soon. But I wish you the best. And as this continues, I'd love to have you back to keep us up to date on what's going on.
Always appreciate everyone's support, and we will see everyone in the sky.
There you go. Thank you, Paul Hartshorn. He's the chair, National Communications Chair for the Association of Professional Flight Attendants, APFA.org, their website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the folks over at the National Labor Relations Board Union, the NLRB union, they tweeted out a couple of tweets talking about Republicans wanting to slash the NLRB's budget by a third. They want to gut the NLRB's budget because, again, there's all of this activity of, you know, people wanting to join and form unions. The number of petitions, I think it jumped, what was the number? 58%. So the number of people going, hey, you know, I want that, skyrocketing. So what do? You squeeze it off to where, yeah, we're going to push it further down the road, make it much more difficult for workers to get their rights and to vote. Now, Republicans do what Republicans do. It's about starving. Remember Grover Norquist? I want government so small I can drag it in the bathtub and drown it. Well, this is what Republicans in the House want to do to the NLRB. NLRB's got a ton of problems. You know, 70 years of bad decisions, 70 years of Republican attacks, and now going to starve what little budget it has. Yeah, again, for all my union brothers and sisters who vote for Republicans, this is what they do to you. So understand, if you need to go on strike, if you need to get something done, if you need to file an unfair labor practice, you need any of that stuff that they do that's so important, well, better luck next time. Because if they slash and burn these budgets, well, you're not going to get anything. Now, our friends over at the Teamsters, this is an interesting story and something to watch of what's going to happen over the coming days. This is a big deal. Yellow Freight, which encompasses Holland, also, I guess, New Penn was part of this, the old Roadway, YRC, all of these companies that Yellow gobbled up. Evidently, Yellow has not made a pension contribution to the tune of about $50 million. And the union has said, hey, we're going to stop providing benefits to the workers on July 24th unless this is paid. And there could be a strike over this. Now, what's interesting is I know a little bit about the Yellow situation because I had worked for Roadway at one point. That Yellow, engaged a hostile takeover and basically destroyed and put them out of business, as Yellow has been known to do throughout the decades. You give Yellow credit in corporate circles for destroying what was a solidly upper middle class, working class kind of wage job. This was a good job in the 80s and 90s. This was above a good job. This was a career. This was the kind of job that people got and never left. When I worked for Roadway, they used to tell their customers that they had a 1% turnover rate, that people came and stayed. They had the best qualified people who did the best job. And Yellow has always been a kind of a bottom feeder who, whatever they touch, somehow they destroy. So I'm not surprised that they're where they are. And the credit that they deserve is they have figured out how to take a job that was at the top of the working class and basically destroy it. To where now they've clawed back, years and years of pay raises. They've harmed their retirement security, and now the funding for the benefits, well, that's been stopped too. Now I see this as a ploy. I see this as a ploy to find out where the union goes. Now O'Brien's taking a big risk here by saying we're going to go on strike because there's the possibility of putting this company out of business. This is the kind of gamble. This is the kind of gamble that you're going to see. This is the will. Does Yellow have the $50 million? And does the union, have they done the research to know whether they do or not? That's an interesting, it's an interesting spot. So I'm waiting to see where this goes. Let's go to Kurt on line one. Kurt, how we doing? What's on your mind, brother?
Doing good, Rick.
Real quick, go.
Up here in Ukraine. So I wanted to talk about the airlines. My wife and I, we left Tucson last Saturday, from Tucson to D.C., and then from D.C. to France, and from France to Poland. So what we're not talking about with these airlines is my wife and I were both, we're part of the clean air movement. And we have one of those Arnett monitors that monitors the carbon dioxides in the air, the buildings, airplanes, etc. the U.S. Airlines, all three, the two planes we were on in the U.S., they're such germ factories that we probably, all the people should have never been on there. The levels read at like 12.50 ppm of the carbons in the cabin.
And how bad is it on other airlines?
What's that?
How bad? I got 30 seconds. How bad is it on other airlines? We'll get to the point. Quick.
It's really bad. The levels dropped as you start to take off. In the European airlines, they all have the air monitors in the planes.
Right.
And I think that's something we're missing in our planes here. And I think it would be a lot for safety on airplanes.
All right. Well, this is something I will bring up to my friends at the Flight Attendants Union. I appreciate the time, Kurt. Got to take a quick break. Back after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
This day in labor history, the year was 1919. That Friday, thousands of workers in the Chicago stockyards walked off the job. A serious union organizing drive had been underway in the yards since June. One of the organizers of the butchers was John Kikulski. John declared it would be a campaign that included workers who were Polish, Irish, Lithuanian, and in fact, every race, color, creed, and nationality. This was an important pledge because earlier unionization efforts had failed to unite the workforce and had often excluded black workers. Yet the years of racial barriers to unionize proved hard to break down. While 90% of the white workers joined the union, black recruitment lagged behind. Tensions between the newly arriving Eastern European workers and more established white workers also simmered. Despite these setbacks, the stockyard owners were alarmed by the success of the union drive. They sent in 300 mounted policemen to disrupt union meetings and monitor the workers' movements. Angered at the police presence, 10,000 workers walked off the job. They returned to work on Monday, but began organizing for a strike. On July 26th, the workers issued their demands to management for better pay and safer working conditions. The next day would be one of the most infamous days in Chicago history. A group of white Chicagoans stoned and killed a black boy who was swimming and had accidentally drifted into a whites-only part of Lake Michigan. For the next week, a race riot engulfed the neighborhoods surrounding the stockyards. 1,000 black families lost their homes to arson. 23 black and 15 white residents were killed. Any hope of racial unity had been crushed, and as a result, the strike failed. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
All those firecrackers on July 4th got me thinking about the headline revolutionaries who signed the 1776 Declaration, fought the Brits for independence, hammered out the Constitution, and installed our Bill of Rights. Old Ben, Monticello Tom, General George, Alex, pamphleteer Tommy Paine, Jimmy and Dolly, Tea Party Sam, and others got America's democratic experiment started. And they're rightly saluted today from schoolrooms to political gatherings of both major parties as true patriots. Reflecting on that generation's remarkable impact reveals the historic potential of our people's democratic spirit. But it also raises the unavoidable contrast with our present crop of leading political characters. This is worth noting now because the 4th has become the opening bell for America's quadrennial presidential run. Yes, ready or not, the first debates are only a month away and Iowa's Republican caucuses are set for January 15. So here's my question. Given the current state of our two major parties, would any of the patriots of 76 have a snowball's chance in hell of being nominated for president of the country they founded? Consider George Washington. The GOP's MAGA crowd would boo him off the stage. Trump would mock the general as Toothless George, and the party of QAnon, anti-woke nonsense, and Marjorie Taylor Greene would place him behind uber-rich ego-trippers like Vivek Ramaswamy and Doug Burgum. Democrats, while today's grassroots Dems would rally enthusiastically to the little-d democratic principles and firebrand activism of Thomas Paine or Samuel Adams, the party's pusillanimous corporate-hugging establishment would bury both in a muddy deluge of money and lies. This is Jim Hightower saying, this political reality shouldn't depress us, but provoke us into demanding and doing better. Maybe greatness is now beyond us, but shouldn't we strive for more than mediocrity and outright goofiness?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it's about time. It's about time someone finally charges the fake electors. And I look today, Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel. And you remember we had Dana Nessel on the program back during the Working Class Heroes radio tour back in October of last year. But she's charged 16 pro-Trumpers, the fake electors, for their involvement in the scheme to overturn the 2020 election. And I looked at some of the charges, and I'm going, okay, one count of conspiracy to commit forgery, get that. Two counts of forgery, okay. One count of conspiracy to commit uttering and publishing. One count of uttering and publishing. I don't know what that is. Sounds bad, though. One count of conspiracy to commit election law forgery, and two counts of election law forgery. I'm going to be interested to see how this plays out, and here to share some thoughts on one, why it took so long to get here, and two, what is uttering and publishing, and what that will get you. And that's why I've asked our good friend Bob Ney to come share some thoughts, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, genius extraordinaire when it comes to the political world. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So, uttering and publishing.
Well, on this one, you need F. Lee Bailey, because I have no idea what the uttering and publishing would be, except if you make a false statement, I think, and if you would publish something that is also false. You publish a document, for example, and your intent is to defraud. That's what I think that is.
Yeah, what the Google's telling me.
But they have published something with an intention to, you know, become electors. It was fraudulent. So I think that's the publishing.
Yeah,
the Google's telling me is an old word they use with it.
Right. The Google's tell me in Michigan, uttering and publishing is defined as a willful uttering or publishing a written or printed statement that is false with the intent to injure or defraud. Yeah. This crime is punishable up to 14 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah. I knew it sounded bad.
The publishing was something they put in writing and they intended to, you know, be fraudulent with it.
Wow. So I come back to this, and why is this taking so long? I mean, you know, if you or I would have done something, you know, the next day, I've argued, you know, why weren't these people arrested the day it landed on the desk, where you go, no, this isn't it. This isn't the one that, no, you're, this is where my mind is. How would come people weren't in bracelets the day it was landed on the desk and presented as authentic?
Well, I think two things is, I'm just going to be, you know, totally in conjecture here. I'm not going to be anything with a sound basis to it. But I think number one, in today's complicated legal world, you know, everything tends to take a long time to dot every I and cross every T. And I think secondly, due to the nature of this issue, being that with Trump, the presidential election, you know, the fact that, you know, they had to hone in on multiple states doing things. You know, of course, some of these were more out front than others. So I think that's the second factor in it, that they want to make sure, and due to the situation, this is rather unique. So I think that's probably the reason that, you know, it took so long. Now, on other things, I would think there's a different explanation. For example, we know that Trump's had a target letter, and that's come from Smith. And one would look at that, and I would at least, and say, okay, did Smith find new information, maybe emails we didn't know about, maybe correspondence from officials in the White House in regard to January 6th we didn't know about and Trump's involvement? Or I think another potential answer to this is that it didn't happen through the Attorney General's office because it just wasn't going to. You know, it's going to take a special prosecutor and the Department of Justice just wasn't going to do anything against the former president. I think that's a potential answer also on that.
So what do you make of the new target letter? Are you surprised that Trump is the target of an investigation on January 6th? Is there any surprise in that?
I'm not surprised. Again, I think there needs to probably be new information that we don't know about. And the reason I say there needs to be, you just sit here and say, why wasn't the Department of Justice capable enough last year, last month, 4 months ago, 5 months ago, to come up with, you know, the same type of conclusion of whatever Smith is coming up with if he's made Trump a target of the investigation? There's a couple answers for that. One, the Department of Justice just wasn't going to go there, which happens. Or, number two, there's new information that we just don't know about that Smith has dug up, and that's another potential answer for that.
See, my thought on this goes along this route of they didn't want to do anything. Nobody wanted to do anything. Nobody in the Justice Department wanted any part of this. And you know, as we found out about the documents and it taking a year for them to go get them, that nobody wanted to get their hands dirty on this. Nobody wanted to get into the middle of it. They wanted to let sleeping dogs lie, and they dealt with Trump with kid gloves. You know, this is one of those things where there's part of me that goes, finally, now that the door has been open, you're getting all of this stuff now coming around. And did you see the story about the kid from Massachusetts who's now saying, hey, you know, you treated that guy who used to be president, you treated him special. You should be treating us special. Evidently, lawyers for the Air National Guardsman, who's charged with leaking documents, is saying, hey, he should be afforded the same pretrial privileges as Donald Trump got, which I find interesting.
Right. Well, you know, I was thinking that, myself the other day, I didn't know about the article, but I was just thinking about, you know, if I was a lawyer for that guy, I would obviously try to make some type of correlation with this. But I think your answer is correct about justice, and that's why I was just saying a minute ago about Smith and the Department of Justice, why they didn't do something before. One of the reasons I predicted that this wouldn't happen is because at the time I looked at the fact that DOJ, in my mind, just looking everything over, wasn't going to act on this. And I think on that end of it, I was correct. I didn't anticipate a special prosecutor that would particularly act on it. Because you do have to go back to the fact, if Smith can act on this, why couldn't justice act before? And I just don't think the will was there. Going beating a dead horse, by the way, you know, nobody, no administration, no political party ever went back and got all the people that lied to us when I was sitting there listening to them on Iraq with all the other members.
And of course, this is where I then wanted to go. I mean, if we're going back in the past and we're righting wrongs,
right?
Can we please? Because I'm dying for you to tell me. You know this, don't you?
Now, all I know is if we maybe pick a middle spot somewhere out in the country and I whisper it, they probably still will hear it. Let me put it that way.
And I would never put you in that position. But at some point, legally, if we're going to be going after this stuff, we should be going after all of it as well.
Yeah, well, I did this for quite a few years on your show when I would talk about the fact that they need to release the 911 information.
Yeah.
They need to release it. And I kept saying they need to release it because in there it mentions the Saudi embassies. And, of course, then, well, we looked at that. Well, who believes that? That needs to be further looked at, of what the Justice Department did looking into the connections of the Saudis.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with former Ohio Congressman and political analyst Bob Ney. I want to get your thoughts on Vivek Ramaswamy, because he's from your neck of the woods.
Yes.
Evidently, over the weekend, he was at the Turning Points USA conference, where he said that, hey, you know, January 6th, that's just a friendly preview of what's to come. If basically they don't get their way, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think what he's saying, you know, obviously, is if you know, they don't get their way, then it's going to cause people to be once again, you know, uprising and in arms. He's also, I think he has said he would pardon Trump, has he not?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he said that. Now, I do want to mention this about Vivek Ramaswamy. He did say something that was kind of interesting about his donors, you know, the ones that he's signing up. He actually does sign them up as fundraisers. But his point is all these big money people pay these consultants big money. They get to keep a percentage. Why not people? It was just, I thought, actually a pretty interesting, you know, answer that he gave.
No, it's gig work. We're turning people into gig workers for political campaigns.
Yeah, right. But yeah, the you know, if I don't know if these candidates today, I think they ought to stay away from if I don't win, or else this happens. I mean, I just think that, you know, try to stay away from that. Let's just have elections again instead of marches.
Yeah. Now today in the House, I believe Democrats have reintroduced the Freedom to Vote Act. Any thoughts on the Freedom to Vote Act?
Well, the Republicans have a bill. I can't even remember what they're calling it, to be frank with you. And I just hope they don't, you know, mess up the system. I hope they don't try to do, well, it won't pass the Senate, but even for the looks of it, I would hope that they would try to stay towards, you know, reformation of the system, make it easier to vote than harder to vote. Of course, anything that the Democrats are going to introduce on this topic is not going to go anywhere.
Yeah, it's dead on arrival.
But you still, you know, still need to do it, still need to introduce it, still need to push it and promote the idea out there. Republicans aren't going to pass anything through either, through the Senate. So.
No, but, you know, back to Vivek Ramaswamy, he also said that Supreme Court justices that he would appoint, Ted Cruz and Bill Lee from Utah, interesting choices. Mm-hmm. Interesting choice. Crazy, but interesting choices.
Maybe Mitch McConnell asked him to get him out of the Senate. Do you ever think about that? you never know.
Yeah, no, look, yeah,
Ramaswamy wants to take the court. It's not right enough for him. He wants to take it further to the right.
Yeah, interesting. We're in an interesting moment because, you know, I'm starting to see some of the, because I'm starting to come around to your thought, because where my mind is Trump is the inevitable candidate in 2024. But now I'm starting to see some undercurrents, like Wilbur Ross, former Commerce Secretary, you know, doing some rounding of donors for Youngkin, the governor of Virginia. There's a super PAC going to spend $40 million on Tim Scott. There seems to be some undercurrents that the moneyed people think that Trump may not be the guy. So I don't know. Maybe I'm not there yet, but I'm rethinking the possibility that Trump may not be the guy in 2024.
Yeah, I first thought this again, not just this past February, but even a year before. Just, you know, trying to look at the tea leaves and, you know, anticipating, you know, some legal problems, especially from New York or particularly Georgia. And I didn't even know about you know, the possibility of a special prosecutor. I don't think this is the last case. He's going to have to find a creative reason, you know, why he's not going to run, because if he stays in the convention, he's going to win the convention.
Right.
I don't care, you know, if he's in prison khakis, he's going to win the convention. But I just don't think it's going to get there.
Yeah. See, I don't, and this is where I had a bunch of people while he was president saying he's going to resign. And I'm going, there's just no way in a cold day in Hades that he's going to resign. His ego is never going to allow him to do it. And this is where my mind is in this moment. You know, he's the front runner. He's you know, he's out ahead. I just don't know that his ego is gonna let that happen.
Well, my mind goes towards the ego and the fact that somewhere along the line, the pollsters are going to show him enough doubt, not of the primary, but of the general election.
Yeah.
And they may even show him the possibility maybe it's not Biden running and what would happen to his particular numbers.
You think it's possible Biden's not going to be the guy?
You know, in today's world, when I first started in radio, as you know, you really had to kind of work to find stories. And now the moments of the weird pop up every hour. And I've just never seen anything happen like this since the last, you know, since 2016 in this country. And I think anything is particularly possible anymore.
Yeah.
That, you know, numbers may get worse. There might be, you know, two candidates that may not run. I mean, I'm not making that prediction, but it, you know, it's possible.
Yeah, no, I think it's possible. Look,
and if it's not Biden, because Biden's numbers are weak, anybody that doesn't want to recognize that's going to help him lose the election. But I will say this: if it's not Biden, I think Trump is, you know, complete toast. If it's Biden, I don't know where I'd bet on that election.
Yeah, see, I think Trump's the only one Biden wins with. That's where my mind goes, because everyone's in their camp. But you know, look, you've got this third way group. There's no labels group. You've got these folks. Maybe Manchin. Now, I think Manchin is going to announce he's going to run for re-election and run against Jim Justice. And I think he'll probably lose. I don't think he's going to run for president. But he's teasing it out that he may be the no labels candidate. Any thoughts on that?
Well, he is. He's teasing it out. I think I'm with you. I think he'll run for the Senate for one more try. You never can count Manchin out in that state. But as far as the, you know, the new independent group, Joe Lieberman and the whole group, they could be kingmakers this time. Usually, you look at groups and say, since Russ Perot, they're, you know, not that effective. In this election, if it's particularly Trump versus Biden at the end, yes, they could be kingmakers.
Well, another instance of Joe Lieberman harming the country, at least. That's my thought.
Joe Lieberman's greatest harm, I love to never let this one go, is the fact that he took the ACA, Obamacare, and he gutted out, you know, the provision on behalf of all the insurance clients, you know, in Connecticut. And there was that stopgap measure that would have taken care of a lot of people. They could have bought into Medicare early.
I know.
He gutted that one out.
And you wonder why I call him Trader Joe.
Yeah, that was a significant piece of legislation that really, it was in the original package from President Obama.
Thanks, Joe. Again, you know, I won't forget that either. But we'll see. We'll see where this goes. But as always, Bob, I appreciate the thoughts, the insight. Good stuff.
And let's not do any publishing or uttering today.
No uttering.
They won't take 2 years to get us, trust me.
Oh boy, you're right on that. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. I'm still good on Dana Nessel. I love her. I think she's fantastic. She is a no-nonsense, you know, take him to the rack kind of person. I'm surprised it took this long. Want to hear your thoughts, though? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. It's a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have a good time.
Tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at therickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. I want to get a couple emails before we wrap things up. Donna sent me an email saying, "Who's the fool you had on? Why didn't you ask what he would do with people who commit crimes, if not prison? Maybe they can live with both of you. What an idiot he is. That's why we have all this crime in so many states." And sent me a link to a Cleveland.com article. And she's talking about the guy who, and you may remember the other day on the program, we had a guy running for prosecutor in Cleveland. And the point that I took from the interview that I thought was most important was the idea of prosecuting power over desperation. You know, when you talk about people who are acting in a desperate fashion, we come down with a hammer. You know, you stole those three peppermint patties. You know, 500 days in jail before your trial. But if you steal from, you know, your workers and you cheat them out of millions of dollars, well, slap on the wrist, promise not to do it again until you get caught the next time. And I understood his point. This point was very, very clear that we're going to go after power. I did ask him, you know, well, what do you do with criminals? You know, and he did say, you know, duh, we're gonna hold them accountable. You know, we're not going to use the death penalty. I'm not a death penalty person. But he didn't say they were going to let them go. At no point did he say he was going to be weak on crime. He did, however, say that there are other things that you can do than locking people up. You know, like we used to back in the old days. You know, when you know, older than me, you know, I think of my uncle's generation. You know, a lot of them would get into trouble at 18, 19 years old. And you know where they ended up? Not jail. They ended up going to the military. Uh-huh. And that straightened them out. There were alternative sentences that were given because we didn't have a for-profit prison industry back then. Now we've got for-profit prisons. Everybody's got to go to prison because we got to get the heads in beds because these for-profit prison companies have 85-90% occupancy riders in their contracts. Whether we're locking people up or not, we're paying for it, so we might as well. So, Donna, nobody's saying be weak on crime. But we're saying maybe, I don't know, maybe do things a little bit differently. Maybe, oh, I don't know, deal with the root causes of poverty that cause a lot of this crime. Maybe just something of that. But then to really use the hammer and go after the powerful, the ones who have been getting away with, well, everything they can grab. Think about the collapse in 2008. How many of those Wall Street criminals were indicted? How many people went to jail? How many people spent a day in jail? So for me, that interview, pretty simple. That interview for me, you know, is one of those things that you just go, it's finally something that I think is important. So that's kind of where my mind goes on this thing. Also, want to get into another email real quick, and this is one of those situations where you just, you know, it's. This is one of those things where you just go, yeah, I have my thoughts on it, and you know, every time we talk about the trans issue, you know, people immediately come to the you're disfiguring children. And again, the extreme view of this. I've said from the beginning, I don't want government making choices that are difficult for families. I don't want to have these kind of very personal things put into a religious zealot frame. And look, I don't know how I would respond if my children we're going down the path. We would go through the doctors and things like this as well, like everyone does. What I know on this, the trans issue, is kids who are in that world, the suicide rate is just through the roof. And the idea of moving towards gender affirming care, whatever that may be, for people under 18, and as I understand it, as has been explained to me by people who know a lot more about this than I do, there are no surgeries for those kids. They don't do that. It's a long path to get to that. Even as an adult, it's a couple-year process. It's not something that you can do in a drive-through fashion, which is what the Q folks and the right would want us to believe, that you know, it's on demand. It's not. This is a long, painful, difficult process. One that I don't feel comfortable having government that tells us that they have a religious view of this stuff. Do I understand it? No. And I'll tell you what I've told every person that I know who's gone through the transition and has done this. I don't understand it. I'm never going to understand it. But I wish you the best. I hope this brings you happiness. I hope this is the decision that you've made that'll make you happy. Now, as Jim has emailed me, well, there are people out there who regret this. Of course there are. There always are. But that doesn't mean that you cut it off for everyone, because ultimately, for too many of these kids, it's life-saving to be able to move in that direction. And I got to tell you, this is a growth moment for me as well. The ability to say, look, some people aren't who they want to be. And maybe we should allow them to pursue their happiness. And this is where you hope that families and parents, they're the ones who are guiding. So, Jim, I'm not with you on the hard iron hand of the law.
You're listening to The Shaw. WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.